Hello and welcome. You are listening live to the 25th episode of the Armand and Akil Show, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. And sometimes we do special episodes like today. I'm Akil Krishnan.
And I'm Armand Rana. It's the 22nd of February at 5.09 p.m. We are broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus, located on the traditional ancestral and unceded territories of the Hankamenam-speaking Musqueam people.
All right. So cold open today, Armand. How are you doing today?
Not bad. Not bad. I've been listening to a lot of audiobooks lately. I've just got, the Vancouver Public Library. You can get audiobooks, and they're great. And yeah, I've just been hooked on it, on that. I've listened to almost 200 hours.
Of audiobooks?
In the last, like, month, yeah.
So what do you do when you're listening to audiobooks? Are you, like, cooking?
Yeah,
or are you
cooking,
just, you know, dusting?
Yeah. I'm on Silo. Have you heard of Silo? It's like a TV series.
Oh, I love Silo.
Yeah, I'm reading the first book. Oh. I'm listening to the first book.
Oh, well, The Wool on Omnibus.
The Wool.
You will not. What a coincidence. I just got an email from UPL today that the Omnibus is on hold for me to pick it up.
Oh, you're going to read it, listen to it.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I believe my eyes, my ears.
When you say cleaning it away, I don't know, people who are familiar with Silo, that's a very important theme in the first book of people cleaning things with wool. So
what's the message?
I'm definitely not doing that while I'm listening to Silo.
I was going to say, what's the message of you not cleaning or not while you're listening to this listening to this audiobook? I was interested. You had mentioned before that you had listened to an audiobook of Bill Morneau's memoir.
Yeah. His
tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I think my biggest takeaway is that everything is a high school project.
Ah.
Yeah, it's just high school. Like, even when you're the prime minister, it's high school. Like, what ended up happening, like, one example he gave was, like, his team, when he was finance minister, did this whole extensive, you know, research and, you know, modeling and whatever to figure out, you know, what is the optimal amount of money to give Canadians during the COVID pandemic. And they came up with some number. You know, there are different trade-offs. You know, if you give people more money, you know, the budget goes out of whack, whatever. Like,
you run a higher deficit.
You run a higher deficit.
You risk more inflation.
Your credit rating, something happens. You also have, the incentive structure changes. So he came up with a number. It was slightly less. It was like 1,600 or something like
That's what you mentioned before, yeah.
Yeah, and then
And they agree to this number.
They agree to this number with the prime minister. And the prime minister goes out on TV and is like, hey, we're giving everyone $2,000. And then when he asked, Bill asked later, like, why did you do that? He said, $2,000 sounds better. So it's just like, everything is high school, you know.
Yeah.
It's that was my main takeaway.
If I had to come down on JT's side on this, Bill Morneau clearly doesn't know politics, the media, or drama.
Yeah.
You know, it has to sound good. Or it doesn't matter what the economics look like on paper. If it doesn't sound good, it doesn't feel good. All right?
Yeah. So yeah, the other thing is, like, he never had like a one-on-one meeting with JT until his resignation.
No.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
One-on-one meeting.
What is it? No. The finance minister didn't have a one-on-one meeting with the prime minister.
Yeah, till his resignation. That was his first and only one-on-one meeting.
Wow.
So the other thing I think what we're learning is, and I also read Jody Wilson-Raybould's, you know, biography. And so they're very different people and, you know, had very different politics. You know, JWL was probably a lot more progressive. Yeah. But the common theme is JT didn't really build individual relationships with his cabinet minister. So, you know, you watch people on TV and you think, you know, these guys are, you know,
Have regular meetings.
Yeah. Have built up some camaraderie over the years of working together, but it's just like a very, it's not a intimate kind of camaraderie kind of relationship. It's just, there's a professional relationship there that exists, but they haven't, you know, even in your workplace, a manager, some
which is what I was going to allude to,
and
right?
Your manager, you'd expect at some stage you get some, you have one-on-ones with your manager. So you, if things are working well, you develop some sort of familiarity that goes beyond the professional with your manager, right?
Of course, because you're dealing with human beings, right?
Yeah.
And there's always this level of there's this levels of the relationship, whether it's a professional relationship, but there's also the personal relationship, which influences how good your professional relationship is sometimes, right? Like if someone is likable, you're more likely to work with them better professionally than if you just do not get along with that person on a personal level.
Yeah, yeah. So it's fascinating. And
no, and you would think, this is surprising to me, right, to hear, because you would think that a prime minister, there's the part where the prime minister isn't supposed to be super cozy with every member of his cabinet because there's supposed to be some independence, especially with the attorney general and the finance minister.
Yeah.
But there's also a level of them actually sitting down, having conversation and making sure that there's some sort of alignment on what the expectations are.
Yeah, yeah. And just like because there's a lot of tension there, it's even more important to develop that relationship. You don't have to talk about work in that relationship, right? You can just...
True, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, he had a beer with Barack Obama, right? Highly televised thing. But, you know, that level of relationship, you see this on TV and you expect that he's actually doing this with all of his cabinet ministers. But he wasn't really doing that. It was partially intentional to create that distance, but I don't think it worked out for him in the end. Because a lot of the more talented cabinet ministers that he came in with in 2015 actually left. He found some new ones in, you know, 2019. You know, Anita Anand, you know, has got generally favorable, you know, reviews. Most people think she did a good job.
Who's now the Anita Anand is now the Minister of Transportation and the Minister of Internal Trade.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I think it's, you know, that's kind of the main takeaways. Anyway, what about you? How have you been?
I've been good. I've been reading, again, books from VPL, made up a significant percentage of the list of the books that I've been reading. I love VPL. It's a fantastic institution.
What do you read? Any besides Silo?
So which I haven't started reading yet. I read, I'm going to say the name of this book. And it's not controversial. Look up the book, right? So I read a book by Sylvain Saipol. He's a journalist out of France. He wrote a book called The State of Israel versus the Jews. And in that book, he basically talks about he himself is Jewish and his father was an ardent Zionist. And he talks about how the his own experience of what his what he perceives as being the benefit of Zionism to Jewish people in Israel, Jewish people who don't agree with the government in Israel, and Jewish people everywhere. It's a really interesting book. So I read that. I most recently read, finished Canada Alone. We had interviewed Professor Nossel a few weeks ago. That was, I read most of the book, but not all of it. And that was also an absolutely fantastic book. Yeah, and I think the book that I'm not really that I'm looking forward to reading, it's not really political, is a book by an author called Erica Fatland, who is a Norwegian author. She wrote about her trip to the Himalayas, but it's kind of an outsider's perspective.
Are you planning to escape to the Himalayas? Is that the solution to our politics?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Depends on how much more upside down the world gets, which we're going to talk about on the show, obviously. Yeah. But depending on that, we'll see.
So what do we have first? What are we breaking down first?
What we're breaking down first is a strangely political sports event, the final of the Four Nations tournament. So for context for our viewers, the NHL, National Hockey League, had an All-Star Week like most sports do, like the NBA had their own All-Star Week. It's kind of a break week where the best players in the league get together. They do things like, you know, in the NBA, it's like shooting competitions, hoops. And then in the NHL, it was like speed skating and shooting the puck, etc. And this year, the NHL decided to have kind of the best players on the national teams, four nations, as the name suggests, come together and just play a tournament. And the final was Canada versus the United States. And there was a lot of conversation surrounding that game, especially with the tensions recently. And so what we have first is a clip of a Nigerian TV host on Arise TV explaining Canada and U.S. hockey.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's go straight in and listen to the clip.
U.S.-Canada tensions, and forgive me, Aaron and Ebi, for jumping into sports. There was a four-nation hockey tournament between Finland, Sweden, Canada, and the U.S., Canada, dying-minute goal, beat the U.S. 3-2 in U.S. soil. Take a look at the reaction.
All right, we're just back while we wait for that ad, that really, really annoying ad to play out. Hey, did you watch the game?
No. I was tracking my phone. I was, as they're going. I don't understand that much about hockey. I was more reading into the politics of what was going on with, you know, Trump calling the players and, you know, telling them that, you know, supporting them, and then some of the players saying that they're playing this game in honor of President Trump.
Oh yes, they did do that. Yeah,
which is like, okay, now like the booing is actually justified.
Yeah, it's explicitly political now. Yeah. All right, we got the clip. It'll be on right about now.
Connor McDavid wins it for Canada. And Jordan Binnington has done it again inside the TD Garden.
Now, why am I bringing up sports? Because it has been so politically charged because of the tariffs, because Trump said that Canada should become a 51st state, dismissing their sovereignty. And look, he was joking, but here is U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance at CPAC, the conservative gathering, where Elon Musk was holding a chainsaw, Malay was there. He made a joke, to be fair, but he said that if Canada loses this match, this was before the match, if they lose the match, the tariffs are going to go up. Take a listen.
Canada made the mistake of booing Team USA, and then they got kicked. Team USA.
Fantastic.
Canada again today, rematch.
Yep.
A message of encouragement for Team USA versus
Absolutely.
Canada.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we'd like you to kick again because you don't boo the United States of America. And to Canada, if you guys don't win, the tariffs are even higher. No, I'm kidding. I can't. That's the president's decision.
Well, they ended up losing. And so people are now saying.
That was an interesting comment by J.D. Vance there. But yeah, it was quite politically charged. We mentioned just before we resumed the clip. And the games happened in Montreal and Boston. And at the Montreal games, the U.S. national anthem was booed roundly. But it's been happening in the NHL everywhere in Canada.
Yeah. And I think the fact that this Nigerian, a reason for Nigeria, there's a random Nigerian TV channel that feels the need to cover the story. I don't think, you know, people outside Canada, or even some Canadians, are taking it as seriously when one country just says, okay, your country doesn't actually exist, right? That's how Ukraine started, you know, 20 years ago. And look where we are with Ukraine,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Putin, maybe 10, 15 years ago, was saying Ukraine is not a real country.
Exactly.
Right? He was saying that. Like, if you look back to his writings, you know, 10, 15 years ago, that's what he was saying. It's not like a new thing for him that he just woke up one day and decided Ukraine's not a real country.
Yeah, I mean, you saw delegitimization of the sovereignty of the existence of the country, and then you end up with there are Nazis running their government, and we need to take them out.
Yeah, right. Then there's some crisis emerges, and the population is pre-trained to believe, oh, this was a made-up country anyway.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. And that is, I think, what is also, you know, that, you know, is, you know, sinister about this is, yeah, maybe Trump doesn't do anything now. J.D. Vance is the, you know, successor to Trump, right? So this belief system, what we're seeing is it's actually, you know, it's not just Trump who's this weird aberration who magically, even though his views don't match most Americans, that's what we hear from the Americans, somehow got elected twice and got a huge amount of votes, and his vice president, you know, has a very similar outlook. His, you know, his party is just singing from that hymn book now, right?
Yeah.
So.
And his party, there's been no meaningful opposition to the gutting of Ukrainian aid or to the 180 in U.S. foreign policy, basically dropping Ukraine and trying to realign global politics with some sort of new U.S.-Russia axis of power.
Yeah, maybe they need Russia's help to help them in hockey. That's a real game here.
I think
that's the reason why we're seeing this is that, you know, Trump's feeling really bad about the U.S. losing at hockey. It's like,
yes.
If we join with Russia now, maybe we can finally beat Canada at hockey.
I think you have a point there. Yeah.
I think that's the game. But how do you feel? How do you feel about Canada defeating the U.S. in the hockey final? What is it?
You know, there's been some contentious hockey finals in history. Canada is one of the best. The best hockey teams in the world. You know, you have Russia, the United States that are kind of in those top three, top five teams. But Canada, time and again, has produced some of the greatest hockey players in history. To this day, has some of the best hockey players in history. Right, Connor McDavid, who scored the last goal, is considered by many to be the greatest player right now, and possibly going to be one of the greatest players to have ever played the game. It is Canada's game in that way, right? Yeah. That there's a cultural element to how much people like care about this sport. And particularly given the environment right now, I think this victory was something that everybody felt like we needed a little bit, just to even, it was like a symbolic F you to this bigger power that seems to believe they can just run roughshod over us in every single way. And it's in the little things, right? I know I have colleagues who don't watch hockey.
Like me.
Yeah. Who the day before the game, we had a meeting. My boss said he watches hockey, but there were people on the team who don't watch hockey, and I know they don't watch hockey, so I talked to them about it. And he said, "Yeah, I'm going to take off at 4:30 today because the game's at 5. I'm going to get some beers, sit down, watch the game." And everybody on the team said, "Oh yeah, we're all going to tune into the game." This is pretty surprising. I don't know that there are many hockey. They won't tune in for the Stanley Cup Finals, for instance, right? And of course, even if you look at the ratings, there were 9 million something people that watched this. And this was like the most viewed sporting event that was not the NFL on ESPN, on Sportsnet, which is really, really saying something. So, yeah, it was very interesting. And as somebody who watches hockey, loves hockey, the way that Connor McDavid scored that last goal was hilarious to me because he is the greatest player on the ice right now. And he was left completely unmarked. So it was so bizarre. And I think the best encapsulation of that was there was a camera angle of Sidney Crosby, who's another goat of the sport. And there was this camera was focused on Sidney Crosby's face as the action was going on in the background. And you can see him smirk the moment you can tell the moment he realizes that McDavid is open.
Yeah.
He's about to receive the puck and the game's basically done, right?
Yeah.
So there was a lot. There was a lot in the game, and I couldn't sit down for OT, and it was overtime, and it was pretty fantastic.
Yeah. But yeah, aside from winning hockey games, what else is happening? What are the other reconfigurations that are happening in Canada's political system as we take on the U.S. The Liberals have a leadership race. How's that going?
Yeah, so the Liberals have a leadership race, as you mentioned, and the front runners is the former Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, and the former Bank of Canada governor, Bank of England governor, and board member of some 20 philanthropic organizations.
And he was also like a Deputy Finance Minister at some stage or something.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Okay. So Mark Carney. And there was a recent interview that Carney had with Rosemary Barton, which I thought was very interesting on Rosemary Barton Live, and I think you had some thoughts on it as well. So how about give a listen to that before we jump back in?
Well, this is the clip we have from that is actually, the portion, quite an interesting portion of it. But the overall interview was very combative.
And it's a 60-minute interview. Yeah. I highly recommend to listeners to watch the entire thing.
Yeah.
It was quite telling. I personally liked what I saw from the candidate in this interview.
And I liked that the journalist was being, which kind of pushing him. This idea that I think people have that CBC is somehow Pravda or some sort of, government mouthpiece. Yeah. If you watch the interview with Carney, you can see that, she's not giving him anything, right? She's making it very uncomfortable, a very uncomfortable interview for him, which is as it should be. And you will never see this particular clip is interesting because, let's just take a listen.
Let's take a listen to it.
Any support or help, it's just the economy.
Why get into politics right now? Have you been offered positions in the past?
I have been offered positions in the past. I was offered, for example, Prime Minister Harper asked me if I would be his finance minister in 2012. It wasn't appropriate to proceed with that. I didn't.
Why wasn't it appropriate to proceed with that?
Well, I was governor of the central bank at the time, and I didn't feel that it was appropriate to go directly from being governor into elected politics. Mm-hmm. We're in a different, and you know, there's been opportunities over time to join the Liberal Party and run. Why am I here now? Because we're in a crisis. This, you know, for better or worse, my career, my experience prepares me for this moment.
Why should Canadians believe you'll do anything differently, though, than Justin Trudeau? You've advised him. You've given him advice. You've been a liberal. So what is going to be markedly different here?
Well, there's several things. First, you started by a few moments ago mentioning that I had 20 different responsibilities. I had 3 full-time jobs. How much time do you think I spent advising the government, quote unquote?
If you listen to conservatives, you were doing it all the time.
if you listen to conservatives, you think a lot of things that are wrong. We're very different people, Prime Minister and I. We have different backgrounds. I was born in the Northwest Territories. He was born in Rideau Hall. I'm a hockey goalie. He's a snowboarder. I focus on the economy. He has had a different focus for Canada. I think we have the same values, and we're trying to achieve the same ends. For this moment of crisis, for this moment where we have to get our economy not just on track, but build it to be the strongest economy in the G7, that's what my experience, that's where it's directly relevant. And the other thing that's, if I may, I think is different between him and I, is my experience in all these different organizations and things over the years, yeah, is the importance of team, the importance of delegating authority, bringing the team along. We've got a lot of experience on the Liberal bench. I want to draw on that experience. I want to add to that experience and bring in outside expertise. There's some big differences, and there'll be big changes because the moment demands big changes.
We'll leave it there. Mr. Carney, thank you very much.
So, yeah, that clip was Mark Carney, Liberal leadership hopeful, talking about positions he was offered. So he was offered a position as finance minister in Stephen Harper's government, eh?
Yeah. It's quite fascinating. Like, I think, you know, the kind of the branding that you're seeing coming up here probably ever regarding Carney is carbon tax Carney, just like Justin, you know, that business. The reality is Mark Carney is quite a conservative politician. Like, he is to the, if he is part of the Liberal Party, he's to the rightward edges of that party, right?
Of course. I think where he's, people kind of are like find him completely palatable is that he's probably not that conservative on the social issues. And so that is a huge factor for a lot of people. Maybe not right now with the crisis that we have, some of which he described, but I think that's something that kind of averages out the candidate for the people.
Yeah, so for some progressive voters, you know, for whom social issues are kind of important, they're like, okay, this guy, at least he's not going to, like, you know, start a, like a witch hunt for transgender people or something, which is what, like, literally Pierre Poilievre seems to intend to do and, like, define them out of existence, right? So, I think that you know, the attempt to try and portray him as, like, some sort of, you know, super left person or having a similar approach to politics as Justin Trudeau is inaccurate, for good or for ill. You know, it's not like they, you know, he actually, I think there was another interview I saw where he was asked, you know, who which politicians do you admire the most, Canadian politicians, and he named Chrétien and Harper.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, he didn't name Trudeau, right? Who's the current prime minister, right?
He's been clearly advising all the time.
Yeah. Right. And Pierre Poilievre was a sitting MP.
Yeah. He was the minister for housing.
No. He wasn't even a minister at the time when Carney was offered the job of finance minister by Harper.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So that's also very interesting, right? You know, the idea that, you know, Pierre Poilievre is, you know, Harper's...
He was part of the caucus at the time.
Yeah, he was part of the caucus, but he wasn't... And meanwhile, Carney was. And some says, you know, at that point in time, you know, things have changed. But at that point in time, Carney was far more, you know, well-respected in conservative circles than Pierre Poilievre, you know, for actual doing actual work, right? So, Yeah. Anyway. What are your thoughts? What did you get out of that clip?
Yeah, I think like you said, right? It was interesting that the Liberal candidate was offered a finance minister position in the last Conservative government, that should, I think, in any other kind of universe, that would be very telling, right? In what that candidate's place would be in the leadership race, but I think that's not really in question right now. He wants to do a lot of things, obviously, that are quite targeted to, I think, the economic problems that the country has right now, like the productivity crisis and the government deficit. I think it was quite. I think overall, like you said, it's quite interesting the attack ads that they're running against Carney, even though he is fully on board with ending the carbon tax. And Carney said he's going to end the carbon tax and replace it with some sort of framework that that taxes carbon emissions on large corporations.
Industrial carbon
exactly.
Tax, yeah.
And he said there's some pretty significant limit beyond which that you would qualify for this. So basically saying that unless you are a significant emitter, I think those are the words he used in an interview, that you wouldn't be impacted by this. But yeah.
Yeah, the other thing I found interesting was towards the end, which is something I didn't notice earlier, but you know how I mentioned that Justin Trudeau kind of bypassed his ministers and just did his own thing and didn't have a good relationship with his team. He did mention when they were asked what's different between you and Trudeau, he did mention that he's a team player, which is interesting. That the theme is kind of coming back. That was the other thing that I took away. So,
and he's saying that he wants to leverage the experience that he clearly sees in the Liberal bench. And I'm also interested to see what that looks like after the elections. I know a lot of current ministers aren't running for re-election. So it'll be interesting to see how that shapes up in the coming months. If you're just tuning in, you're listening live to the Armand and Akhil Show on CHR 101.9 FM. We've just been talking about the Canada-US relations, the Liberal Party, the race for the Liberal Party leader. And we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we have a lot more to talk about. The Canadian elections,
We've got some new polling out from Ledger.
Exactly, yeah.
And we can talk about that.
Vancouver politics, it's American politics, all after this quick break.
Devon Cole is a woman in total control. Unafraid and unashamed, Cole has burst onto the scene through her expertly crafted feminist pop anthems, packaging social truths into repeat-worthy bops. This is the era of fempop, and Devon Cole is an artist you don't want to miss. Join Devon Cole on her Two Shades Blonder tour and see her in Vancouver at the Biltmore Cabaret on March 16th. To find out more and get your tickets, visit admitone.com. That's admitone.com. I should be swimming, but I'm a fiend for the troublesome boy. Devon Cole is a woman in total control. Unafraid and unashamed, Cole has burst onto the scene through her expertly crafted feminist pop anthems, packaging social truths into repeat-worthy bops. This is the era of fempop, and Devon Cole is an artist you don't want to miss. Join Devon Cole on her Two Shades Blonder tour and see her in Vancouver at the Biltmore Cabaret on March 16th. To find out more and get your tickets, visit admitone.com. That's admitone.com. I should be swimming, but I'm a fiend for the troublesome boy who's driving me wild. Keeping me on the tip of my tongue.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening live to the Armand and Akhil Show on 101.9 FM, CITR 101.9 FM. We were just talking about the relationship between Canada and the United States, the Liberal leadership race. And now we're going to talk a little bit more about the election itself. There was some new polling that Armana mentioned just before we went on break from Léger. Do you want to take it away?
Yeah. So we from the headline summary is from February 14th to 17th, they surveyed Canadians in federal politics. If a federal election was held today, 33% would vote for the Liberal Party, 41% for the Conservative Party. So an 8-point lead for the Conservatives, but that's much lower. You know, we were seeing like 20-something leads, you know, most of last year. And then they asked their, you know, their people, if Carney was the leader, Liberal support would rise to 39 to Conservatives 40. It basically at that point, and two things to say here, you know, if the Liberals are within 1 point of the Conservatives, most likely actually Liberals will end up with more seats.
Right.
Just because the Conservatives are vote is not vote efficient.
Yeah.
It's very concentrated in Alberta and Saskatchewan.
As it showed in the last election as well, right?
Yeah. And Liberals vote is very efficient because they win a lot of seats in three-way races in Quebec and also sometimes in BC and Ontario as well. And we can have a whole conversation about, you know, proportional representation, which I do support. But funnily, Conservatives never support, even though, they are shortchanged by it.
Even though they would have come away with more seats in the last election if there were proportional representation.
Yeah. The other thing is that this is kind of, when you ask people hypotheticals, sometimes those numbers can be a bit inaccurate. So I'd say the truth is maybe somewhere between those two numbers.
Right.
The base level support of the Liberal Party and the hypothetical. The other thing is the Ontario election is going on right now, which can skew these numbers a bit as well.
For sure.
Because people are confused, like, which election are you talking about? The other thing that I want to bring up, which is we haven't really talked about the other front runner in the Liberal race, which is Chrystia Freeland. You know, why are we not talking about her? She was the one who resigned, that brought about all this. You know, why are we not talking about her?
I think there's a couple of reasons, right? One, I think realistically people associate Chrystia Freeland with a lot of what the Trudeau government has done over the past 9 years, up 10 years now, actually, almost coming up on 10 years anyway. I think that's a huge part of it because they were tied to the hip for most of it, right? And she was finance minister, and she was deputy prime minister. But there's also the momentum that Mark Carney seems to have in terms of fundraising and support from the current Liberal caucus, for why she seemed to have been catapulted into the front runner, being the front runner in this race. What do you think?
Yeah, and I'm trying to see this poll. A previous poll I looked at, even in terms of the hypothetical numbers of Freeland, it kind of echoes what you're saying. I can't pull it up right now, but a lot of them had Chrystia Freeland either 1 point above or 1 point below the Liberal Party's base level of support. In the margin of error of that, and not really significantly improving that number. So, that's the other thing that, that even the data is bearing out, is that voters don't view her as really offering that change.
Exactly.
That's kind of the
And I think the
trap
the,
she's kind of in at this moment.
Right. And what you mentioned, right, that she's the one who brought this whole thing about with her scathing resignation letter. I think, honestly, it's being seen as a too little too late, right?
Yeah.
She should have walked away probably much, much earlier.
Yeah, and I think it's also the way she came into the role as finance minister because of that, Bill Morneau thing we were talking
about.
Exactly,
yeah.
She came in basically as the person who was going to say yes to Trudeau's, budgetary proposals. And
yeah,
that doesn't set you up really well in that role because kind of when you are a finance minister, you are supposed to have some degree of tension with the prime minister. But if you know that the previous guy just left – because of that tension, it kind of prevents you. And it's not necessarily her fault, but it kind of prevents you from executing on that role well.
For sure.
Because, you know, the moment that you deviate, you're going to be out of a job.
Yes. Which is exactly what happened, right? No, maybe the moment she deviated, I'm sure they were, there were times where the message weren't, at least towards the end, the message weren't exactly in lockstep. But it's almost exactly what happened at the end, right?
That, yeah, I think it was actually more sinister. I think what happened is Trudeau realized he was getting hit hard on the economy, and his plan was he wanted her to own it.
Yeah.
So he wanted to remove her from the finance ministry and kind of create this narrative that all the, you know, incorrect or whatever handling of the economy, so-called, yeah, that took place over the last few years was her doing. And now he's fixing the problem by removing her.
Right.
Right? That was kind of what he was, you know, attempting.
All the while doing the tax hijink, right?
That weird, you know, Christmas stuff, which maybe saved me $5.
I
bought a book or something.
Yeah. And I mean, mixed reactions on that, just as a short aside, right? Mixed reactions on that. There's no consensus on whether or not it actually benefited any Canadian, like en masse benefited Canadians. And the reason I say that is because that's exactly what Chrystia Freeland said in her resignation letter. It's like, this is not, these hijinks aren't what we need to be focusing on. We need to be focusing on the threat that the United States poses to us right now.
Speaking of hijinks, what's happening at the municipal level?
Oh, at the municipal level, as we all know, the ABC ruling ABC party that the Mayor Sim is the leader of has a supermajority on council. Recently, not that they're, I wouldn't say their coalition is cracking, but recently
it's cracking.
I mean, come on, I think the core is firmly, you know, like firmly entrenched. But you see some of the members who you kind of wondered why they were even in ABC to begin with, because you didn't really think that maybe what they said previously aligned, or it just seemed like a marriage of convenience, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of showing now. So what happened? Would you want to take this away? Like, give us a little bit of a description?
Sure. So basically he came out with this kind of very almost like, Elon Musk-like or, you know, Trump-like proposal, just like, we are going to, you know, stop all supportive housing projects in Vancouver.
Right.
Which is like, okay. You know, there's so many.
Which is the policy you need when you have so much housing that people are like, please stop doing this. There's so many abandoned apartments. It's not okay.
Yeah. Vancouver's a ghost town. You know?
Exactly. I was driving for miles and miles and miles in East Van and not a soul to be seen.
Yeah, there's just like, there's nobody here. And like, everybody's like got 10 houses each. Yeah. So yeah, that's his plan. And the reason he's doing this, which is that part at least kind of makes sense. What he's doing doesn't make sense. His reasoning is, you know, Vancouver is 25% of Metro Vancouver, but has 77% of the supportive housing in Vancouver.
Yep.
So the other parts, like other cities, Burnaby, sorry, etc., are not building as much supporting housing as Vancouver. And he feels this is unfair to Vancouver. And, you know, so he's, you know, throwing the toys, so to speak, out of the...
What's the T word? A tantrum.
Yeah. He's throwing the toys out of his out of the basket. I think that's it.
Yes.
You know, the other thing is, Surrey also doesn't have a lot of other, you know, services. I think they got their first maternity ward or something. Or like the second, like they have a lot of, like, when you talk to people in Surrey politics, they're like, you guys have a functioning city with a lot of great public services. We don't.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are a lot of, Vancouver is prioritized in a lot of ways, for better or for worse, for a lot of public investment historically. And Surrey is, treated as the unwanted stepchild.
But even 20 years ago, Surrey wasn't considered any kind of major concern for anyone, right?
Yeah, it's continued till today, even though Surrey is the fastest growing, you know, area in Metro Vancouver. So, you know, the solution to these kind of challenges is actually, you know, collaboration, negotiation, you know, come to some agreement. But that's not, you know, Ken Sim's approach. And so,
And there's something also to be said, right? That yes, Vancouver maybe has borne the responsibility of building social housing, but there's also something to be said that Vancouver is by far economically the most powerful municipality in the Metro Vancouver area, right?
Yeah.
So when you have more money, you're expected to pull more of your weight, right?
Yeah, and we have more public, like we have more hospital capacity, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. We have more transport capacity. We have more stuff.
Yeah. We have more stuff. Yeah.
So anyway.
So anyway, the, as because of all of this
brouhaha,
yes.
I love that word. Anyway, go yeah. So then we have Rebecca Bly, who said, yeah, let's maybe not do that. Let's actually talk to, so who's a member of his party. She's like, let's talk to the province, you know, and come up with some plan together on how to deal, you know, with these concerns of yours, and have them, you know, come speak to council. And, you know, and have maybe other municipalities come to speak to council before we go ahead with this plan. That was weirdly blocked by Rebecca, what's her name?
Sarah Kirby Young. Yeah.
Who is the wife of NDP MLA Terry Young.
And cabinet minister.
So it's just like, what's going on here?
I'd love to be a fly on the wall at their dinner table. Right?
Yeah, it's just like, how does this work?
Yeah.
Anyway, so here is Rebecca Bly's talking about why she's leaving ABC.
All right, let's take a listen. Give us a second here. We're having some technical difficulties with the PC.
Yeah, it's so I'll just keep talking. Yeah, it's interesting. And the other thing is Lisa Dominato actually, you know, was supporting, you know, Rebecca Bly's move. Actually, Rebecca Bly didn't leave ABC. She was removed from the party.
Yes.
By Ken Sim. And she received a phone call from some dude she's never met or ever talked to before. And he was just like, hey, by the way, you're leaving the party, which is, you know, and quite interesting.
So, unfortunately, the technical issues continue with the PC. Do you have a quick rundown of what she basically said?
She basically said what we talked about. That she, you know, she has a different point of view on this issue, and she expected, you know, him to be a leader to take different points of view, but he's not that man.
Don't worry, he's going to go to his private gym to mull it over, and then he'll be back with better ideas.
Yeah. He needs to spend more time in the gym.
Yeah, he needs to spend more time in the gym. All right, we're going to move on to the United States, where there's been, honestly, a drought of news over the past month or so.
Yeah, nothing's been happening
there. Yes, we had to really, really, really dig deep, deep down in order to find this. But apparently they're cutting...
Sleepy Donald Trump.
Yes. No, I think it's that one was the other one. That one was the old corrupt fascist one. This one is Diaper Don. they're obviously talking about a new budget down in the United States, and the latest budget proposed in – was this in the House or the Senate?
I think it was the House.
It was the House that carried that's carrying basically significant – cuts to Medicaid.
Yeah. So I think the way that I look at this is there's this drama that you're hearing about in the news. I think we'll start with the DOGE thing because I think that's kind of in some ways linked to this because it's like that's
actually kind of the headline, right?
Yeah. So this DOGE ceremony that's going on, like they are trying to save, they're very open about this. They are trying to cut $2 trillion over a decade from the budget, the U.S. government budget, which has an annual budget of, I don't know, is it $5-6 trillion?
About $6 trillion, yeah.
Yeah. So they're trying to cut, you know, $200 billion a year. And they set this goal for themselves. And they've already cut the entire Department of Education. Go ahead.
I just want to make one correction there. I believe they want to cut $2 trillion per year.
I don't
know. Which is what, this is where the $200 billion, cutting $200 billion is something that is considered maybe possible with, in some painful decisions. What he said in the weeks before and after the election, until people kind of really pointed it out that wasn't really possible, was that he wanted to cut $2 trillion out of the budget per year.
Yeah, okay. So he wants to cut $2 trillion per year out of the budget. But to pay for Trump's tax cuts, you need $200 billion per year, is my understanding.
Okay.
You can't really pay for that. This Doge business.
Yeah.
You have to go after Medicaid and Medicare.
Yeah.
Right? This Doge business, they made a statement where they've so far saved $55 billion, where they've basically cut all U.S. aid, cut the Department of Education. The reality is, when people actually looked into it, the actual estimates of how much they've saved is between $2 billion and $8 billion. Okay? So that's the reality. It's actually, part of it is just theater to cover what they're actually doing, which is they're going to cut Medicaid, which Trump said he wouldn't do, but he's doing it. He's supporting this budget, right? So that they're cutting, $1 trillion from Medicaid. That's what they're doing, right? Medicaid is the program in the United States that provides health care to the working poor. These are people who work full-time jobs, most of them, and they get paid close to the poverty line. Yeah. That's how the formula is calculated. So when you cut, you're cutting health care for the poorest working Americans when you cut Medicaid.
Exactly.
And the other thing they want to do is cut SNAP program, food stamps.
But also in terms of the amount that you set for Medicaid that they're going to cut, they're basically cutting everything in Medicaid. The numbers kind of trotted out, and without the percentage, unless you actually know, you don't know just how bad it is. Unless you actually know what the budget looks like, et cetera, they're cutting upwards of 90% of the Medicaid budget is what that represents.
I was trying to look into the thing. Is this $1 trillion over per year that they're proposing to cut, or $1 trillion over 10 years? My hope is it's $1 trillion over 10 years, either way, it's a devastating cut. If it's $1 trillion over 1 year, that's the entirety of Medicaid that they're cutting.
Yeah.
But I think that they're cutting $1 trillion over 10 years.
That's the other thing. I didn't see the detail, but when I saw that number, where they said the cuts to Medicaid would be around $1 trillion, I think it was like 890 billion or something. Yeah. That's basically the entirety of the Medicaid budget.
Yeah, I think it's $1 trillion over 10 years. And that's half of how much they need to pay for their...
the extension of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act.
And that's also where this tariff, dance comes in, right? Which is they want... Who pays for tariffs in the end?
Yes, Americans.
It will cause economic harm to Canada. But in terms of the distribution of Americans who pay it, everybody pays for it, right? These tax cuts for Donald Trump has trotted out... is for the wealthiest 1% gets the vast majority, 80% of the benefit, right? So they're replacing, they're cutting Medicaid and they are taxing working class people more. That is the overarching theme. This Doge song and dance about cutting, financial, the foreign aid and all this stuff, it is to provide a veneer of legitimacy and just point the finger elsewhere for where, this money's coming from.
It's another rug pull, right, on the American people. Yeah.
Yeah. Do we have the clip? Is it come back?
I believe we might have the clip. Let me see if I can just pull it up. Correction. I'm not able to click on anything. Hold on. Let's continue musing on this while I try to click away.
Okay, let me tell you another Doge story. So Elon Musk claimed that there were 150-year-old, he called them vampires, stealing Social Security. You've got millions of 150-year-olds. Nobody's 150. So he was basically saying these are fake people. They're stealing Social Security benefits from Americans. He trotted out this claim, okay, and then people looked into what he was claiming.
Well, yeah, of course, because, as he himself said, don't believe everything I say, because a lot of the stuff I'm going to say is going to be wrong.
So yeah, people looked into it, and it turned out he was looking at the wrong database, first of all. So the database he was looking at was not saying who was getting Social Security benefits.
Right.
It was just a general database of people's Social Security number.
Yeah.
150 in that database represented someone who
might have been one of the first ones to get a Social Security number.
People who were born before 1920, so most of those people have passed away, and who have people, they're unsure of their date of birth. Social Security has a rule that anyone over 115 years old gets cut off from Social Security. And if you look, they have very detailed data on their government public website on the age distribution of people getting Social Security benefits. The number of people even over 100 years old who receive Social Security benefits is negligible. It's like less than 0.1%. It's just like when you look at the graph, it just like it doesn't even show up in the graph.
Yeah.
It's so small.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Elon Musk is lying.
Yeah.
That's what's happening.
Of course.
He's, it's great. I think great. Government efficiency is great.
You should always preface, statements like that with breaking news. Elon Musk is lying.
Yeah. Breaking news. But yeah, it's, it is what it is. I think, it's great to have government efficiency. Elon Musk, based on his experience, is someone, if he wanted to, could actually provide government, improve the efficiency of government. Yeah. He's worked in various tech companies, built successful businesses. But, based on what he's doing, he is not doing that. He is just concocting things and lying to all of us.
Because the business of actually cutting government spending and making the government more efficient is a difficult thing to do if you do it right.
And
if it were easy, it would have already been done, right?
Yeah,
it would be an exercise we do every 2 years, every something.
If you could cut $2 trillion from the budget.
Exactly, annually. Right? and especially considering that fiscal hawks have been in government for a long, long time, right? And they've been in positions where they've controlled all levers of government before. So if it was something easy that they could have accomplished, they would have already done it.
And maybe there are things that are easy. Like, I'm taking it faithful. Maybe there are easy things that could be done. But this is not it, right? This is just like, you're looking at the wrong database, bro.
Yeah.
Just calm down.
No, I guess that's the part that's the most ridiculous, right? You're looking in the completely wrong area. Like, you weren't even looking at the right data. And as somebody who is data-driven, someone who says, I have a STEM background, you don't even know what data you're looking at.
Yeah, you just calm down. And I wonder why, because you sent out an email to all federal employees saying, we'll pay you out. You can quit your job.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And so the people who actually know which is the correct database to look at, they're gone.
And you have a
bunch of teenagers who are poking around and like, hey, maybe this database looks interesting.
Yeah.
Let's make a public statement about this.
Exactly.
So that's kind of...
They don't have to worry about people getting too old and collecting Social Security in the U.S. The U.S. by G7 standards has an abysmal life expectancy.
So I just saw this report where COVID saved the U.S. government hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yeah, literally, because they botched the response to COVID and a lot of old people died, right?
Yeah.
A lot of their citizens, and this, the worst part of it, beyond the loss of life and all of that, is that a lot of these people, that demographic voted overwhelmingly for Trump.
Yeah. So anyway, it's calm down. You stay off the ketamine. You have some talent. You're a talented individual. You can do better. Be better. Yeah. Be best.
Yeah. I'm going to see if I can pull up this one thing. I know entertaining folks here a little bit longer than we usually do, but I just want to see if we can get this one thing going before we call it a night. And I just wanted to. So what we want to just quickly wrap up with is the Ukraine-Russia war. Trump had said that on day one this will be done. On day one, I'm going to tell Vlad, we can't do this, buddy. It's over. All right. He was going to say he was going to get the war over on day one. Is it day one already? Is it past? What's going on?
No, it was just not even day. It was going to be when he was elected.
Oh, before. Yes.
On his election day. Just the fact that he was elected.
Just the specter of Donald Trump's reascendancy to the White House was gonna scare Putin so much that he's going to, you know, just come back to the table like, I'm so sorry. He started tears in his eyes. Sir. This really big Russian man on a horse, tears in his eyes, like, sir.
I don't know. It's actually very concerning, you know, what is happening there over there. It's he's trying to muscle some rare earth minerals for Ukraine.
Well, he's being the second bully in the equation, right? Yeah. Ukraine is the victim state here. They were the victims of an unprovoked assault that first began 2014 with the invasion of Crimea, and then in 2022 escalated to a full scale invasion right past into Donbass, Luhansk, and into the.
So he's trying. I don't know what's going to happen. It's very disturbing. I think for a lot of people in Europe, they're concerned about their own security posture. If America no longer supports Ukraine. I think this like rare earth mineral deal might actually happen in terms of like US will continue to support Ukraine to some degree in return for this basically stealing.
Because it doesn't seem like they have any other option, right? Even though Trump has a reliable history of not following through with any contract he basically signs.
Yeah.
Any contract he basically signs is going to end up in court and you're going to end up fighting it for years and years and years. And at this point, probably after this guy dies.
Yeah. So, it is concerning. I think, any other takes on that?
I just wanted to play the press secretary of the United States.
Is it working?
It is. I you know what? We're going to give it a go right now.
I can expect Putin-Trump meeting, and where? Will it be in Saudi Arabia or any other place?
I don't have anything to detail or to read out. Right now, the president and his team are very much focused on continuing negotiations with both sides of this war to end the conflict, and the president is very confident we can get it done this week.
What makes him confident?
What do you think it'll take with him?
She's very confident he can end the war this week. But I think what was interesting was the follow-up question. Obviously, she didn't answer is what makes him so confident. I'm going to take a wild guess here. Absolutely nothing. any closing thoughts, Ramon?
No. I think we've gone a bit over time.
All right. A few other things to wrap up. You can find us at The Armonic Hill on Instagram and Twitter, so check us out there. If you like the show, please, please, please leave us a review on Spotify.
The music for the show is composed by the incredibly gifted Sarah Pratt. Every note she writes is an ode to humanity, elevating our souls to heights we never knew existed. We do have some awesome shows with a set of guests lined up for you. Do continue to listen and subscribe. As mentioned, you can find all of our episodes on our podcast feed, so do check them out.
Thank you. Have a good night.